Hello, Dan Alasso with Making History Again, with another episode of Peppermint Kings. And today I want to finish the third chapter, which is called, as you may recall, Essence and Peddlers. And so I think when I left off, I was talking about how much Ashfield was making on peppermint oil. So I'll continue. In 1835, Ashfield's tax assessors began recording the town's assets in much greater detail. In addition to buildings and machines, financial assets and farm animals began to be counted and taxed. But for the first time, the assessors of 1835 found no stills. George Ranney had moved to Phelps, New York in 1833, and Roswell Ranney was making final preparations to follow him. Roswell's taxable assets in Ashfield had dwindled by the summer of 1835 to a fractional interest in a sawmill worth $100, a single horse and cow, and $3,000 money at interest. One of the last members of the family to move to Phelps, Samuel Ranney, had not yet begun selling off his assets. His 1835 assessment included houses and barns, acreage and animals, but even Samuel no longer distilled peppermint oil in Ashfield. The Ashfield merchant Jasper Bement, whose assets included a factory and a shop valued at $700, still bottled essences, but no longer distilled peppermint oil. Bement's other assets taxed in 1835 included four horses and a cow, stock in trade worth $350, which probably consisted of the essences and wares that he supplied to his peddlers, and $2,000 money at interest. Bement's relative by marriage, Roswell Ranney, seems to have been one of the early conduits of Western New York peppermint oil to Ashfield. Jasper Bement's account books show the shift in Roswell's role from local peppermint oil producer to broker of New York oil. In 1833, Bement's account books had recorded handling fees Bement had charged Roswell to process oil when Roswell had owned his own still. In 1836, after Roswell moved to Phelps, Bement's accounts recorded transactions with Roswell involving bulk peppermint oil. And in 1838, after 3 years without a home in Ashfield, Roswell Ranney was once again taxed for a small house and garden in town, valued at $100, as well as a cow and $3,020 money at interest. Apparently, Roswell's business connections with Ashfield remained substantial enough to justify a part-time residence on the town's main street. As families like the Burnetts, the Rannies, the Beldings, and the Bements left Ashfield and expanded peppermint growing and distilling into Western New York, discussed in the next chapter, the town's rocky, uneven fields were converted to pasture for the town's growing herds of sheep. By 1835, when peppermint stills had disappeared from Ashfield, the town was home to 7,748 sheep, valued at $1.25 each. Even Roswell Ranney, who no longer lived in Ashfield full-time, invested in the new venture. In 1838, he was assessed for $2,652.50 money at interest and for 150 sheep. In December 1833, the New England Farmer and Horticultural Journal and the Boston Courier reprinted an article from Greenfield's Franklin Mercury that serves as a retrospective of the Ashfield peppermint venture. The article, entitled Essence Peddling, began, "There is not a town in the East, nor a prairie in the West of the United States, where the essences and the essence peddlers of Yankeeland have not been seen and heard of. Nor do we believe there is any business which has been so much debated and whose origin is yet so little known. It commenced about 20 years ago in Ashfield, in this county. Although a great many pretty properties were made there, while the place enjoyed a monopoly of the business, vast supplies are now derived by the Ashfield merchants from Phelps, where many Ashfielders had recently moved. The article described peddlers who, in flocks of 20 or 30, have sometimes taken their departure from the place in a single day to the east, west, north, and south, bearing goods from all nations lumbering at their back, making money and driving bargains with invincible perseverance under the very noses of the stationary traders. The large number of full-time Ashfield peddlers, the article concluded, was increased by the infinitely greater number of those who made this business an apprenticeship to regular country trading and an avenue to moderate wealth. In addition to the ready availability of Western New York peppermint oil that could be purchased from family and trusted friends, another factor that may have encouraged Ashfield merchants like Jasper Bement to give up distilling was a growing temperance movement in the town. As an Ashfield clergyman recalled in a memorial address reprinted in the town history, "The inhabitants of this town have suffered much from the scourge of intemperance. Many of the distilleries first set up for the distillation of mint by a little additional expense could be employed for a part of the year in distilling cider." He described the movement he had led to discourage drinking, concluding that although one or two distilleries and a few retailing stores and some temperate drinkers stand in the way, yet the purifying process is in progress, which will not stop until the whole town and region is reclaimed from the cruel grasp of this common enemy. Although Ashfield's temperate drinkers, such as Bement and Henry Ranney, seem to have thought the Prohibition movement's goals were themselves a bit intemperate, everyone admitted there was some truth to their claim. In May 1827, a group of Ashfield residents, including a deacon of the church, his sons, and several others, were washing sheep in the town pond. Under the influence, six men loaded two sheep into a large canoe and took it out on the pond. About 10 yards from shore, the canoe sank. The deacon's 18-year-old son, a 28-year-old neighbor, and two brothers, aged 15 and 13, went under and did not resurface. The deacon, who had been watching them from shore, jumped into the water and also disappeared. All five drowned. While Ashfield's famous essence business was not blamed for the 1827 tragedy, townsfolk regarded the stills with increasing suspicion. And many of the farmers who had done the difficult, time-consuming work of growing and distilling peppermint had moved to the area around Phelps in the early 1830s. Since the peppermint straw distilled into oil is bulky and perishable, distilling is always done as close to the fields as possible. When Ashfielders stopped growing their own peppermint, they no longer needed their stills. And the era of the Yankee essence peddlers persisted only as long as the single generation of merchants like Bement and Ranney who supplied them. Without peppermint and the widespread prosperity created by the peddler trade, Ashfield's prominence faded. The 1910 History of Ashfield remarks, "It seems hardly credible that the cultivation of a single crop should have anything to do with the lessening of the population of Ashfield, but facts go to show that the rise and fall of the peppermint industry here affected the population seriously." In the second half of the 19th century, many American farmers became enmeshed in commodity markets, sending their harvests and livestock to urban centers for processing into standardized food products. The details of this commercialization of agriculture vary from place to place and are key elements of the hotly debated market transition. Although the argument over the market transition often devolves into disagreements over the definitions of terms such as capitalism, the change in agency brought about by the rise of commodity agriculture and development of impersonal markets is a key to understanding the mentalities of rural people. But too often, historians have restricted their view to commodities such as wheat that were most suited to undifferentiated aggregation, shifting power from atomized producers to central processors. In the most extreme examples of this reduction of agency, farmers lost their independence and became mere raw material suppliers for an industrialized food system. But the well-documented history of this decline tends to obscure the fact that many early American farmers were innovators who worked hard to increase the diversity and value of the products they offered. As historian Martin Bruegel has observed, early American farmers straddled two worlds that historians and ethnologists have often tended to construe as incompatible. When we fail to recognize that many rural people understood the complexity of systems within which they operated, we deny the agency that seems very apparent in the actions and documents of the Rannies and their associates. Because most American farmers today grow monocultures of ever-decreasing diversity, it's easy to forget that since the beginning of the Columbian Exchange, Euro-Americans and others have been importing new plants and animals and spreading them across the Americas. Early American farmers were always on the lookout for new opportunities to feed their families more efficiently and to produce novel products for local and distant markets. John Rolfe's theft of high-quality tobacco from the Spanish Empire breathed new life into the Virginia colony of Jamestown. The reintroduction of potatoes, carried to Europe by the conquistadors after their discovery in the Andes, by Scotch-Irish settlers in Maine, created an industry that continues to this day. The American enthusiasm for chicken breeding that produced a hen fever in the early 1850s with the opening of Chinese ports after the Opium Wars, and the introduction of premium livestock breeds such as the Merino sheep that grazed on Ashfield's pastures suggest a mental flexibility and interest in innovation that we do not currently associate with American farmers in particular and rural people in general. It should not be surprising that farmers like the Rannies and their neighbors quickly took advantage of the opportunity to diversify and add value once Samuel Ranney had brought peppermint roots to Ashfield. It is worth restating, too, that the Ashfield farmers who grew and distilled peppermint between 1812 and 1835 produced a well-differentiated commercial product for a direct consumer market. Although most Ashfield farmers continued growing staples for their families and hay for their animals, there was no local first subsistence to surplus trajectory. Peppermint was a commercial commodity from the outset. The peppermint oil industry challenges the paradigm that the undifferentiated nature of commercial agricultural products inevitably leads to the concentration of power in the hands of urban processors. And it suggests that the traditional agrarian history of independent yeomen gradually drawn into urban-dominated commercial markets that eliminated their agency is incomplete. The Rannies were central to the growth of the peppermint oil industry in western New York and Michigan, but they were not the first family to carry peppermint to western New York. Peppermint roots were introduced to Phelps by the Ranney's neighbor, Archibald Burnett. It is fair to say, however, that the departure of most of the Ranney's from Ashfield caused the abrupt end of peppermint growing there. The first Ranney family to sell off its stake in Ashfield and move to Phelps was that of George Jr., the youngest son of the senior George Ranney who had first moved the family to Ashfield and was the inheritor of the original family farm. Youngest sons typically inherited in rural early America because older sons usually had started their own families and farms long before their parents were prepared to retire. Youngest sons were still in the household when the parents became too old to work the farm, and they generally took over the work and cared for their parents in their declining years in exchange for an inheritance. George Ranney was well established in Ashfield when he decided to move. He had inherited the family farm in 1822 when his father, George, had died at the age of 75. The younger George had married Axa Sears in 1811, and they had 8 sons and a daughter who lived to adulthood. In 1830, George's property consisted of a house and barn, 46 acres of improved farmland, and 66 acres of unimproved land. Although George's property was valued at only about a third of his cousin Roswell's, he was a substantial landowner running a successful farm in Ashfield. George sold out, and in August 1833 moved his entire family to Phelps, except his third son Henry, who remained in Ashfield, living in Jasper Bement's household. Apparently pleased with the prospects of his new home, George encouraged his relatives to join him. In February 1835, Roswell's son, Horace Ranney, bought a farm in Phelps, and in June 1837, Roswell made the first of several purchases in Phelps, buying a farm from peppermint farmer Frederick Vandermark. In February 1838, George bought a 105-acre farm on Flint Creek in Phelps for $5,000. The substantial price Ranney paid shows that the region was already very well established by the time he arrived in western New York, and that the Rannies were quite prosperous after their years in Ashfield. Samuel Ranney's move to Phelps in 1835 was certainly influenced by George, Horace, and Roswell's success there. But Samuel's decision to leave Ashfield seems also to have been precipitated by a new wave of social turmoil, revolving once again around Ashfield's Congregational Church. In January 1834, Massachusetts finally disestablished the church, which had dominated the state since the days of the Puritans. Unlike New Hampshire to the north, which had separated church from state in 1790, and Connecticut to the south, which had banned government-supported religion in 1818, Massachusetts retained the Congregationalism of its colonial origins as the state's official religion until 1833. Facing the sudden loss of its ability to forcibly tax the residents of Ashfield and compel their attendance, the church's leaders looked for other ways to retain their authority. The Ashfield church's solution came in the form of an evangelist named Mason Grosvenor, who was called to Ashfield in his first ministerial assignment after graduating from Yale's Conservative Divinity School. Grosvenor and the leaders of the Ashfield congregation immediately set to work combating what they characterized as extreme licentiousness in the town. Part of their program focused on prosecuting the town's physician, Dr. Charles Knowlton, for publishing America's first birth control manual. Another part involved admonishing residents whose attendance had lapsed and who had failed to pay their church tax. Grosvenor and the church leaders continued to use the word tax in spite of the fact that they were no longer able to compel contributions with the force of law. One of the church's immediate targets was Samuel Ranney. The 62-year-old farmer had neither attended services nor contributed to the congregation in years, and may have seemed an easy target for a church leadership eager to set an example to intimidate the flock. Grosvenor drew up a list of charges against Ranney, accusing him of, quote, a transgression of the laws of Christ's kingdom by withholding his support, both pecuniary and personal, from the ministrations of the word to this church, and a violation of his covenant vows, voluntarily, solemnly, and publicly made to this church and to God, consisting in almost entirely absenting himself for several years from the worship. In addition to failing to contribute and attend church services, Grosvenor wrote in his notes on the case, Samuel Ranney had denied the And then he wrote existence, but crossed it out and wrote reality of a future state, and declared himself not in the least responsible to the laws of Christ's kingdom, which the minister declared manifested contempt to this church, its laws, its peace, and its fellowship. The church wrote Ranney a letter of admonishment, insisting that he confess and repent his transgressions and immediately resume his attendance and financial support of the congregation. The alternative, church leaders warned, was excommunication. Excommunication in a small religious community such as Ashfield was not an idle threat. Like shunning in other traditional communities, excommunication split families and ruined lives. The church under Grossvenor had resorted to this punishment before, targeting another old Ashfield farmer named Nathaniel Clark, who had been overheard in a tavern criticizing the congregation's ongoing persecution of the town's doctor, Knowlton. Clark had tried to protest the church's actions to the congregational hierarchy and had endured hearings and church tribunals before finally giving in and humbling himself before the congregation. Samuel Ranney was familiar with Clark's case and did not take the threat lightly, but his reaction was not what the church expected. On May 20th, at the conclusion of the four-week period the church had given him to consider its threat, Samuel Ranney delivered the following letter to Grossvenor. To Reverend Mason Grossvenor, misspelled, Chairman of the Committee of Christ's Church in Ashfield, Sir, I received your letter of the 22nd ult, containing charges against me as a member of the church of which you are pastor, which charges I am requested to take into serious consideration, and I have done so. The first charge amounts to this, a transgression of the laws of Christ's kingdom by not paying away my money to support preaching. Now, as Christ's kingdom is not of this world, and as I have no knowledge of any other world, nor consequently of the laws of any other world, you should not be surprised that I should transgress the laws you speak of, inasmuch as I know nothing about them. I once thought that I did, but that was when I took names for things and supposed that immaterialities were realities. And as to pecuniary support, it cannot be expected I should give away my hard earning for what I consider of little or nothing worth. The second charge is a violation of my covenant vows. To this, I have only to say that the same consistency, the same honesty which required me to make these vows when I did make them, now require me to disregard them. As a man's opinions and feelings are not voluntary nor under the control of his will, but are governed by circumstances, it is the height of absurdity for me to promise what my opinions and feelings shall be at a future time. The most I can consistently do or be required to do is avow what they are at the time being. I, therefore, this day excommunicate the Church of Christ in Ashfield for my further support and membership. And I do hereby request the chairman of the committee of said church to read this at the meeting appointed for acting upon my case. Your fellow townsman, Ashfield, May 20th, 1834, Samuel Ranney. Samuel Ranney's letter is remarkable in several ways. First, of course, for Ranney's dramatic, preemptive excommunication of the church, but also for Ranney's discussion of names and things, immaterialities and realities. The language suggests that Ranney was not a simple old farmer who had lost interest in supporting the church, but rather was someone who entertained radical opinions about the role of religion in his life and in Ashfield society. The specific terminology he used also suggests familiarity with the ideas of the local freethinker, Dr. Charles Knowlton, who had published a book on the subject a few years earlier entitled Elements of Modern Materialism. The fact that Knowlton was a country doctor living in Ashfield and that Ranney was familiar with the argument of a 456-page atheist tome Knowlton had self-published suggests that in spite of its remote rural setting, Ashfield was the scene of one of America's earliest philosophical challenges to organized religion. Knowlton had been prosecuted for offering copies of Elements of Modern Materialism to students at Amherst College, and he had lectured to free-thinking audiences in Boston and New York City. Once again, rural Ashfielders were at the forefront of an intellectual and cultural movement traditionally believed the exclusive interest of urban intellectuals. The apparently deliberate misspelling by Ranney of the pastor's name and his decision to sign his letter to the church, "Your fellow townsman," when the expected customary closing would have been "Your brother in Christ," also seems to stand as an accusation against people Ranney believed had wrongly put religious orthodoxy before social solidarity, and as an expression of his wider, more cosmopolitan view of citizenship. Ironically, but unsurprisingly, the words "your fellow townsman" were true only for a few more months. Samuel sold his farm and followed his brother and cousins to Phelps in 1835. At the same time the Rannies were settling into Phelps, they were simultaneously setting the stage for the next phase of the family's expansion across America by purchasing land in Michigan. In spite of President Andrew Jackson's 1836 specie circular, which had declared that Western lands had to be paid for at the land office with hard money rather than with paper notes, in 1837, Samuel Ranney, his son William, and many of their Phelps neighbors traveled to the Detroit land office and bought land on the frontier. Perhaps the elimination of speculation based on credit in the form of paper banknotes had convinced the Rannies and other New Yorkers that the opportunity presented by Western land was legitimate. In any case, on March 13, 1837, Samuel bought a farm in Phelps, and on April 15th, he and his son William purchased a 160-acre and a 40-acre parcel. Samuel's health deteriorated rapidly, perhaps exacerbated by the controversy in Ashfield, the move to Phelps, and the trip to Michigan. Years later, Henry Ranney described his uncle as enterprising and successful, but overtaken by some misfortunes as age drew on. He made his abode in Phelps, but was broken in health and died the following year. Samuel wrote his will in April 1837, naming his wife Polly and friend Russell Bement as his executors. He died on June 28, 1837, leaving his recently purchased Michigan land to his minor son, Frederick. His estate inventory included notes for debts owed him by Russell Bement, by Samuel's son-in-law, the Michigan merchant, Nehemiah Hathaway, and by the local peppermint oil producers, Vandemark and Company. Samuel's wife, Polly, and their four children all ultimately moved to Michigan, where at least one son, Frederick, remained active in the peppermint oil business. In 1847, Henry Ranney received a letter in Ashfield from his cousin, Frederick, then living in Centerville, Michigan. Frederick wrote, "Dear sir, I am obliged to call on you for the money on that peppermint oil that was sent last fall. I have some money to make out in a few days or sell property at a low price." Lucius nor Lewis, Henry's brothers living near Frederick in Michigan, cannot help me to money this fall, therefore I shall expect it in a return letter. You must write on the receipt of this, for time is short with me. Let me know what you can do. Although the first peppermint king had passed, the Rannies remained active in the peppermint oil business. Roswell Ranney continued to prosper in New York, where he built a large house, a barn, and outbuildings, all out of fieldstone. Roswell dealt largely in peppermint and other essential oils, acting as a conduit for New York peppermint oil into Ashfield and other eastern markets. Roswell kept between $3,000 and $4,000 at interest in Ashfield for years after he moved to Phelps. And as mentioned earlier, bought a small house on Ashfield's Main Street in 1838. In 1845, one of New York's new peppermint merchants, Lyman Hotchkiss, wrote to his brother Hiram to tell him about peppermint oil, quote, which old Ranny took to the New York City broker, David Dowse, and requested him to ascertain the most he could obtain for it. Roswell remained active in the peppermint oil business well into the 1840s, when the Hotchkiss brothers are typically believed to have controlled the market. Apparently, Roswell was acquainted with the same people in New York City, and his opinion was worth something even to his rivals, the Hotchkisses. A few years later, Lyman wrote Hiram again to say old Ranny had returned from his trip to New York and Boston, and Lyman had met with him. He told me that if he had an offer for 10,000 pounds of oil for 10 shillings, he would not take it. At the same time, he said, he had contracted 200 pounds with one of his old customers in Boston, and he no doubt should be obliged to pay 12 shillings to fill his contract. The old customer in Boston could well have been Roswell's nephew, Ranny, who had a business in the city in 1845 and 1846. Roswell died in September 1848 at the age of 66, apparently unexpectedly because he had not prepared a will. He left a substantial estate of $44,215.43, consisting of real estate, bonds, mortgages, and notes, which was distributed equally among seven beneficiaries. With Roswell's death, Henry Ranny in Ashfield became the principal member of the family involved in the peppermint oil business. But the business had expanded, and other families had taken the center stage. Our focus is on Phelps and its peppermint kings in the next chapter, and then we revisit the Rannies as they carry the first peppermint roots to Michigan, establishing a peppermint oil business that straddled the country from Boston and New York to the pioneer farms of the Yankee West. So that's the end of chapter 3. I hope people found that a little bit interesting. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you again next time.